Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Conley, Judge Bratfold, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Francis J. Conley presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated, please.
Good morning, and welcome to the Court of Appeals. Our first case today is Lang versus Flagship Bank et al., A22-1199. It's my understanding, that a respondent is going to be splitting its time, and I think I got a letter on that. Would you let me know again, in terms of respondents, who is representing who and how much time you're each going to have?
Good morning, Your Honor. Don McNeil on behalf of Flagship Bank, Jerry Moyna, and Tom Cross. And I will have 10 of those 15 minutes.
And you'll be going first?
I think we'll have Mr. Buterin go first.
That's fine. And then, Mr. Buterin, you're representing Mark Elliott and the others, and you've got 5 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor, and then I would follow appellant by five and then Mr.
Okay. All right. As you are all aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondents will have 15 minutes in total, as divvied up, as you just told me. And then appellant will have 5 minutes for their rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level. It does go up and down. And just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please. And again, this is A22-1199, Lang versus Flagship Bank et al. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Michael Mahoney. I am appearing on behalf of the appellant, James Lang. I want to make sure you can hear me clearly. I thought the mic produced more than it does.
I think you're just great, Mr. Mahoney. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Conley. The appellant here is seeking reversal on several orders of the court, dismissal on the what I'll refer to as the Elliott defendants, summary judgment with respect to several claims for my client, the appellant, several orders dismissing matters, and then finally the denial of the motion for a new trial, specifically as to damages. I'm going to try to focus my time separating the concepts between the Elliott claims and the bank and bank officers' claims. With respect to all of the claims, there's a central theme, which is the court failed to apply the correct standards of law with respect to our recognized standards for dismissal, our recognized standards for summary judgment. For dismissal, the court accepts as true all of the facts set forth in the complaint and then must construe the facts in those complaint most favorable to the plaintiff and give all inferences to the plaintiff. Here, the court failed to do that. With respect to summary judgment, the standard is similar, but there it's evidence. And the issue becomes, did the moving party establish that there's no material facts in dispute, and then the facts must be viewed most favorably to the non-moving party, and all inferences must be accorded to the non-moving party. The court failed to apply those standards, and that's why we're seeking reversal. I'll start with the Elliott claims. And a couple matters that the court should keep in perspective. First, because most of the claims relate to to statute of limitations affirmative defenses, the moving party has the obligation to establish that affirmative defense. It's not the obligation of the pleading party or the responding party to establish that element. The court applied the wrong standard. Taking the facts in the Elliott complaint, want the court to pay particular attention to there's three, I'll call them buckets or silos of property. First, there's real property. Next, there's equipment. And finally, there's antiques and furnishings inside two cabins. And the court muddled the distinction between those. And the court made no distinction between those, and the preference and the reading of the claims in the complaint and the evidence submitted by Mr. Lang establishes that those three categories are treated differently. So we start with, in the Elliott complaint, there's the first matter is a claim for breach of loan agreements. The standard as applied by two cases in Minnesota is there's no damage with respect to a loan until the final payment is not made. So in the Hansen case, the court made it clear that if you can have an economic claim but no damages, the accrual doesn't occur until the damages. The court analyzed the claims with respect to these loans and said, well, the first loan was in December, it went to January, and then there's an extension of that, but you can't extend those because it's an oral agreement. There's no doubt, there's no dispute that none of the agreements were in writing. We don't dispute that, we don't contest it, but all of the established, because it's a motion to dismiss, all of the elements of the elements of the loans are established in the complaint, and not one of them exceeds or is impossible to be paid within a year. So the statute of frauds has no application. So the first loan goes to less than a year, the second loan goes to less than a year.
But I mean, it's all real estate, right?
No, no, Your Honor. Judge Connolly, there's...
The property is not real estate. I mean, I understand the personal property, but the underlying mortgage is related to real estate. Would that be a fair statement, Mr. Mahoney?
Yes, there's no doubt. So let me try to deal with that.
You're saying because the damages relate to personal property, the statute of frauds provision dealing with real estate doesn't apply because your damages are only related to the personal, well, the property, excuse me, your three buckets. those three buckets are not real estate, so therefore the real estate application of the statute of frauds doesn't apply.
I'm sorry, I didn't do a good enough job of making it clear. The first claims relate to contract claims, a series of loans. And the argument is the statute of frauds and the statute of limitations barred those claims. Specifically with respect to contract claims, my argument is the facts stated in the complaint establish a series of loans, renewals of the loans, payment of money on the loans, renewal of those loans with new terms and conditions. Payment of money, an option to deliver real property, an option to deliver personal property. So with respect to the loan payments and the renewals of the loans, the statute of frauds does not prohibit loans that are renewed where new consideration is given, we're going to have a new loan, and they'll extend for a certain period of time, and there's no provision in any of those requiring that they be paid beyond 1 year. All of them are payable within a year. So the statute of frauds has no application.
Counsel, I'm still not following your argument. So as I read the district court's analysis, it is important to your argument that we accept that this loan between Elliott and Mr. Lang was extended, right? Because the initial term was payment, I think, within 1 year, roughly, yeah, something like that.
January of 09.
And the district court was unable to do that because it was an oral agreement to extend, and the oral agreements necessarily involved Lang's interest in real property.
It's not, I hear you, Judge, and that's categorically not correct.
Not correct because?
None of the statements in the complaint identify exclusively real property.
I hear that word exclusively, and I accept that. That's not the point that the district court focused on. It's that the terms involved an agreement as to real property between Lang and Elliott.
Sure.
They'll have to be in writing. I mean, we have a Minnesota statute on this. There's nothing the court can do to overlook that.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor.
That we can overlook it?
No. That a loan, so let me try with the elements. There's a loan to pay money, $600,000. And the first time the loan comes up for renewal, it's extended. And there's a new term, new period. There's no doubt it can be extended. By oral agreement, it can be extended. Then subsequently, about halfway through the term, there's an addition to provide payment, transfer personal property. I don't think anybody disagrees that they can have an agreement to transfer personal property. That doesn't violate statute of frauds. Then there's an additional provision that an option may be to provide real estate. So if we have an agreement that has different terms, and one of the terms relates to real estate, my submission to you, Judge, is that because it includes real estate, it doesn't vitiate or void all of the other provisions. Because they add a provision that payment can be made by real estate, does not mean that that loan is void under the statute of frauds. And then there are two other exceptions.
And the case law you rely on for that is what?
Submitted in my brief. There are two cases. And there's also a case that provides you can have an extension and that the court will not encourage fraud in the inducement to allow somebody to make a promise, I'll give you some real estate, make payments in money, $125,000 in money, promise to pay personal property, and then try to take advantage of the statute of frauds. There's a readily available exception, and it's in an equitable determination. It's not fair. Statute of frauds was not intended to encourage a fraudster. So with these...
The terms of these agreements, were they all to expire or within a year? Or
the terms of
like,
each...
The maturity date for all of these oral agreements, was the maturity at all like within 1 year?
Yes. Okay. So none of them, if you look at each of these, and there's like 12 different matters in there, none of them go beyond a year, and none of them are impossible to be paid within a year. So then we get to the...
None of them required
that they be paid beyond a year. Okay. All of them allowed for payment within a year, which is part of the statute of frauds analysis. So then we go...
The maturity date was... They all had to be paid within 1 year of the date of it's an oral agreement. The date of the agreement. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement, Judge.
All right.
So I've got 5 minutes left, and I want to try to deal with the other subject. So what I tried to point out in our brief is that the cases dealing with damage establish that because these loans continued for a period of time, there can be no statute of limitations because there's no obligation, no damage that occurs until the last payment, which is in 2015. Now, I'm sorry, but my time, I want to turn to a little bit of the analysis of the bank case. In the bank case, there's two groups, the bank itself and then the officers of the bank. So I want to turn to one item that I think is easily understood, which is the court dismissed a claim under 504B, finding that the statute dealing with evictions. And the eviction statute provides, at the very beginning of the statute, it applies to any eviction with respect to a tenant or other occupant. So preparing for my argument today, I decided to do just a quick and dirty research on cases having to do with foreclosures and eviction. And what I found was an immediate response to just simple terms, 504B, eviction, foreclosure, 50 cases, all holding, and it's readily recognized that banks use the statute to evict a person who's in the property after a mortgage foreclosure. So the statute applies almost, I've never seen a case in which it did not apply with respect to removal of a tenant after foreclosure. The trial court held it only applied to tenants. It's categorically wrong. It's not supported by any case law. The respondent's position is, well, if you look back at a 175-year-old analysis of the statute, it didn't apply then, and it sort of had the same kind of analysis.
So, counsel, I understand you cited those 50 cases in your brief?
No. I cited
five. I didn't see them. That's why I'm asking. So
yes. I cited five cases.
Okay. And you think all the five cases you cited basically say the same thing as those
50? Yes.
Okay.
They stand for the proper. Two are reported and three are unreported cases, which critically hold that the statute applies to any occupant following a foreclosure of a mortgage, and that's what happened here. Now I want to turn to the last element in the item because it's important for me to at least get this before the court. The last item that for which we're seeking an order of the court is for a new trial as to damages. It's a complex analysis, but fairly simple to understand. Before I do that, I want the court to understand clearly there's these three buckets. There's equipment outside at Little Pine and Big Sandy. There's personal property inside Little Pine. That property is the property that Mr. Elliott did not buy until December of 18. The bank had title to it before then. The last item is the real estate. So the analysis of one sentence which says Lang learned, did not know he had lost his property, he's referring to real property, when he learned that he lost everything. When you read the five paragraphs before that, it's clear in context he's referring to his real property because there's other paragraphs subsequently referred to his items in the cabin, and he submitted in his testimony and in the complaint that he couldn't get in the cabin. With respect to damages
for all of these damages, Mr. Mahoney, is the valuation based for all of them on the expert witness who in turn relied on representations from your client?
No, okay. Because we never got there with respect to Mr. Elliott. And the notion that the experts only relied on Lange is not correct.
What did they rely on then?
Their own individual searches. These are two independent.
Searches of what?
First of all, there are videos of the cabin with respect to cabin. There are pictures. There's one item. There's a UCC filed where the bank had pictures of many of the items, 35 of them. So they looked at those pictures. Then Lange had a 2008 financial statement in which he listed various items. So the bank had that statement from 2008. And when they identify an item by name, you can look at it. So
So a list of items, and you, all right. Give me an example of one of those items.
Sure, there's two categories. So internally, there's furnishings and antiques. So there are videos of many of the antiques, and that expert did his own research with respect to those items. Outside equipment, there's what's called a skid steer loader, and there's a large item which looks like a big old-fashioned name, steam shovel. Those names are recognized in the industry, and that expert did his own research and analysis to find that kind of equipment. Mr. Lange identified in his interrogatory answers 400 items, listed them by name, location, what he paid for them, and what their value were. And those items all tied out to be very similar. 2008 financial statement, experts 1 and 2, and the final statement with respect to those items. So it's not true that they relied solely on Lange's statements. With that, my time is up unless you have questions of me.
Thank you, Ms. Bromley. You will have 5 minutes rebuttal, and I know I'll have more questions. All right, we'll now hear for counsel, the first respondent, Flagship Bank. Is that Mr. Elliott at all? Is this Mr. Buterin?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Buterin.
Good morning, Your Honors, counsel. May it please the court, my name is Steve Buterin. I'm here on behalf of Mark Elliott and his companies, Creus Inc., Elliott Manufacturing, and Little Pine Lake Property, to ask this court to affirm the district court's decision dismissing appellant's claims against them. The district court in this case properly ruled that plaintiff's claims were untimely and barred by the statute of frauds. And this is a case that exemplifies the utility of Rule 12. The purpose for Rule 12 is to test the legal sufficiency of a plaintiff's claims and to dismiss claims before the parties expend a lot of time and money and resources pursuing claims that would ultimately fail later on in light of summary judgment and other mechanisms. There are two types of claims here. There are claims that relate to the Elliott loan, and then there are those that relate to the return of property. The Elliott loan, the claims center on the failure to pay the amounts due and to acquire and transfer property that Mr. Lange felt that belonged to him or was his former property. Contrary to appellant's arguments, the district court did apply the correct legal standard. The district court did view the facts in the light, accept the facts as true, as alleged, and drew reasonable inferences in favor of appellants. And despite that, the district court was left with the determination that his claims did not pass legal muster. If you look at the Elliott loan, it was entered into in December of 2008. There's no writing. We don't know exactly what the terms are beyond what appellant pledged they are. Then there were approximately 7 amendments after that. There was one on June 10th, 2010, I believe, June 1, 2010, May 31st, 2011, May 25th, 2012, May 20th, 2013, May 14th, 2014, and May 11th, 2015. Of those seven amendments, four run afoul of the statute of limitations because they call for the transfer of legal title and possession of real property. And under
so counsel for appellant has two comments about that. First of all, he says that that was only an option in the extension, so not an integral part of the agreement to extend the loan. And secondly, that the case law would then, or case law under the statute of frauds, would only void that portion of the agreement to extend that related to real estate and not the other parts. How do you respond to that?
I would respond that the way the language of the complaint is styled, that it doesn't present it the transfer of property as an option. It's not a smorgasbord. It says that that was part of the agreement, that Mr. Elliott would acquire and transfer title to the property in question.
So you're saying that that's not how you read the allegations of the plaintiff?
Correct.
Right, Mr. Lang. Okay, correct. Thank you. And then how about the second point as to what statute of fraud voids? Does it void the entire agreement to extend or only the portion that dealt with the real estate?
Because the provision calling for the acquisition and transfer title, that's a material term of the agreement or the amendment, and it can't be separated out. And the language of the complaint doesn't allow for that to be separated out because the way it is styled, it refers to that the acquisition and transfer of property as a material condition central to the agreement. So the four that are void are the...
Well, could the property have been transferred within a year under the terms of this oral agreement?
Could it have been?
Yes. I mean, what did it say? Did it say that this property is going to be transferred within a year?
To be honest, I can't recall the exact language off the top of my head, okay. But I would submit that the...
Because, you've only got a couple seconds. I don't want to...
Well, with that, Your Honor, I'll rest on the arguments presented in my brief, and we would ask that the district court, or this court affirm the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Buter. Mr. McNeil, sir, you'll have 10 minutes, please.
May it please the court, my name is Don McNeil and I represent Flagship Bank, Jerry Moyna, and Tom Cross. Counsel, we respectfully request that the district court be affirmed. As I understand, there have been four issues that have been addressed out of this case that had over 600 entries in the trial court docket that has gone through a number of years, all about
foreclosure. Yes, I was here for one of the appeals. Believe me, I'm slightly aware of the case.
And I'll point out one of the cases that has already been before this court, the Yorkman case, does give the roadmap for the Tom Cross and Jerry Moyna dismissal based upon the statute of limitations. I'm going to address the two issues that the appellant raised during his principal argument, the 504B and the damage calculation. Our brief did provide the court with two Supreme Court decisions that are controlling as to the statutory interpretation of 504B and its predecessor statute. We also provided the court with a published decision from this court, the Mitchell case, that the district court relied upon in holding that it does not apply in the circumstance. There are unpublished decisions from this court that are non-precedential that may support the argument of the appellant that any other occupant may apply, but they're unpublished decisions. The controlling precedent that this court has is this statutory language, this two Supreme Court decisions, and the Mitchell decision that the district court relied upon. There's also an alternative basis for affirming the district court, which was not addressed by the district court, but was raised in our arguments below. Namely, under the statute 504B.365 subdivision 4, the jurisdiction was exclusive with Crow Wing County to deal with his personal property. It had no business being raised in Hennepin County. As a practical matter, a Hennepin County judge doesn't have authority to tell the Crow Wing County sheriff what to do with the personal property located in that county. The statute's clear that any issue related to that personal property should have been brought in Crow Wing, and it was not. It should have been brought on a timely basis. So on that issue, we believe the district court
was there any allegation that this property was not stored in Crow Wing County?
As I understand the allegation, everything that we're talking about was based in Crow Wing County, and then there is the Big Sandy property that the district court also dismissed for the lack of having any evidence that the bank took anything. There's lots of evidence of other people being at the Big Sandy property. Anybody else could have taken that property if anybody took the property. And I say that's a big if, because I don't think that other than the plaintiff saying something was missing, there is no proof to back it up. For Crow Wing, what we have is this property that is out in the woods that some described as a higher-end deer camp that had personal property and had some outside construction property. When the bank foreclosed, it was left there. Mr. Lang continued to rent it out even after he didn't own the property. He's alleged that the bank took stuff, but he was still renting it out to people, even telling them how to break in, even how to tear down the gate to get in, to get access. That's why the jury could easily have concluded the bank didn't take anything. But what the bank does acknowledge is it hauled off certain pieces of outdoor equipment as they were trying to clear up the property to sell it. That's why the jury found that the bank had converted certain pieces of property, because we hauled it off, and then Lang came back and said, I want my stuff back, and the bank sold it. That's why the jury reached its conclusion that it was worth about $7,000. How do we know? That's the second issue the appellant raises. How do we know that that was a proper number from the jury? Well, number one, they had the pictures of what was taken. We also had the Hiller auction. We went and had that Kevin Hiller testify at trial. He talked about what the stuff was worth and how much it sold for. That supported the jury's decision. The jury's decision was, I thought, was higher than it should have been based upon the nature of the equipment was there. We had the testimony from other people noting that the stuff from the pictures, you could see the oil leaking on it, and it would need a lot more maintenance work to make it even usable. But that's the number the jury came up with, and I think that was fully supported. For those reasons, Your Honor, I think our brief has covered all the other issues, and unless the court has any other questions, I respectfully request that the district court be affirmed.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Mahoney, you'll have the last word, sir.
Counsel and judges, I'd like to start with the complaint and point out a couple of paragraphs in the complaint that I believe establish what I've been talking about in terms of property. So paragraphs 134, the court has the complaint, and 131 of the complaint use these words. The Elliott Companies agreed. Now, this is an amendment in May of 2014. Elliott Companies agreed to acquire all of Lang's property at the Little Pine, not Little Pine, its equipment or inside materials, and acquire the Pope County property, and deliver possession and title to Lang, and pay Lang $10,000. So three elements, one real estate, clearly personal property, and money. The same is true with respect to paragraph 134. So there's three clear buckets. I don't believe that the law in Minnesota is clear that if you add one element suggested by, we call the fraudster, that real estate be added, that it vitiates a $700,000 loan. With respect to the Bjorklund decision, Judge Conley was the presiding judge on that case. I want to point out a few things that make Bjorklund not applicable. The Bjorklund case only dealt with equipment. Bjorklund was accused, and the facts alleged in the complaint were that Bjorklund went to the property and he picked up the outside equipment. Has no application with respect to other equipment, has no application with respect to equipment, personal property in the cabin. There was items inside the cabin. Lang testified, and the complaint in the Elliott case identifies he couldn't get in. That property had substantial and significant value. The Bjorklund decision also relies on two elements, which I want to clearly point out. One is there's two decisions relied on, the Phelps decision and the Gems decision. The Phelps decision is a 1958 decision, which we go back to basically code pleading almost. And that decision, Phelps said, if there's an admission, that admission stands for basically forever. You can't undo it. But the decisions which related to Phelps and GEMS have to do with circumstances in which there's also a Rule 36 admission, and the other party agreed that there's an admission. Here, none of those are present. Then with respect to affidavits that may be submitted in terms of dealing with allegations in a summary judgment motion, a plaintiff has an absolute right to submit contrary evidence with respect to when a summary judgment is motion. That's the only way that they can present the evidence, either by testimony, documents, or affidavits. The reference to the aerial decision has to do with witnesses. A witness's statement will not stand if it contradicts other evidence. There's no evidence that was submitted here that suggested that Mr. Lang, as the court pointed out, had 112 specific paragraphs which related to contradictory facts not considered by the court. So here, when we have the two cases where we have with the Elliott decision, it has to do with the complaint itself, and when those allegations are read and the proper statute of frauds, proper statute of limitation, proper inference is applied, the statute of limitations does not run. When applying the proper analysis in the summary judgment standard, Mr. Lang produced his affidavits, and one of the most critical ones is at the very first summary judgment motion, he produced an affidavit contradicting the notion that his property had been taken and the bank didn't say anything about it. His affidavit was the bank represented to him that his personal property, and we're talking about equipment now, would be kept safe and would be returned to him, or he'd be notified if anything was done to the property. That's a submission which the court considered. The other submissions by Mr. Lang had to be considered. They could not simply be ignored, because the only way a summary judgment motion can be decided, it's evidence. He submitted evidence that contradicted those facts that allowed him to establish a material fact dispute. I think, Judge Connolly, you had some questions that I want to leave with.
No. I believe me, I'm going to ask them. I'm going to wait.
Oh, fine. Back with respect to the analysis of the jurisdictional question, the argument was that argument was made to the court. Well, it was rejected by the court. The court impliedly rejected the argument that it didn't have jurisdiction. In fact, they brought it to the court. So they can't have it both ways. We want the court to dismiss it, ask the court to dismiss. They win on that argument, and now they come back and say, we have a right to appeal with respect to a different issue. That issue was not preserved. There's no cross appeal with respect to related appeal with respect to that. I see my time is up.
My one question, even on the damages issue, fine. Let's say you've got your photos and the pictures, and your expert, went online and traced it, and the antique looked like this one. I mean, at the end of the day, the jury is free to not to believe. The jury is free to disregard any of that testimony, right? They could just not believe it.
I think the standard is the jury's analysis still has to be reasonable. If somebody says this airplane is capable of flying and the jury says it's not, that's not a reasonable conclusion for a jury to reach. Here, there's no facts, none, to support the conclusion that the items that were taken from Lang's property were valued at $7,700. There's no fact with respect to what was inside the cabin. None. Nothing. Except our evidence. There's no...
Yes, I get it. You can get on the stand and say, I had the Mona Lisa in my cabin, and now it's gone. But the jury... Maybe that's a bad example because it's the Mona Lisa.
No.
It's only one place. But, whatever. A Renoir. And, by God, it was there, and no one testified that it's not. I mean, the jury can say, well, that's, no, I don't believe you. I'm listening to your testimony. I see you're talking about the Renoir, and, I don't buy it. So, I mean, why can't the jury do that for all of the expert testimony? I mean, juries disregard expert testimony from people from, the best places the best places money can buy, and juries have a right to disregard that. I mean, why can't they do that here? I don't believe it was worth this much. I don't believe it was there. I don't believe that picture accurately represents the condition at the time it disappeared? I mean, why can't the jury just, I don't believe any of this.
I don't think our law supports the conclusion that a jury is free to reject all the evidence and has no evidence to support that number. There's virtually no evidence, and nobody's come up with a number and said it's this and this and this and that and something else. It's just a spitball. And we don't support that analysis from a jury, especially when all this evidence was introduced from multiple sources. No one contradicted it.
But, I mean, your witnesses, the damage witnesses were cross-examined, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
They were cross-examined. And I
believe me, I have no doubt they were.
Oh, no, they were, Judge. And I think if you look at the testimony, there was just questions about what about this and what about that. But there's also Lang's testimony, Lang's interrogatory answers. Norm Danielowicz, who worked there, testified the equipment outside was worth $1 million. And there's nothing to contradict it.
And thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much, Mr. Mahoney. Thank you, Mr. McNeil. Thank you.